This is the second panel discussion. Uh-oh, he's ready to go.
Yeah. Let's go, man.
The question that we're meant to address here is very similar to the one we just addressed. Again, what could or should the federal guidance document say to encourage placement of mitigation where it would have the greatest benefit and probability for long-term sustainability, but where if you want to think about this in the context of a district without extensive watershed planning.
Without any
watershed planning already in place. We had originally designed a scenario for this revolutionary group, which has saved the coup. We're not going to rely upon the scenario, but I'm sure nonetheless we'll have some very good nuggets for us here. We have half an hour, so until 10:50, so you can do with that time what you would like. We're at your disposal. Again, and then we're going to be followed by a final facilitated discussion where we're really hoping to get these nuggets of truth from you after these 2.5 days. We want you to kind of distill all the information you've taken in and get your feedback on what you think could or should be in this federal guidance. So with that,
okay. All right. Well, we were also directed that maybe this time of stage that PowerPoint might be a little bit too much, so we're going to reluctantly not show you our 300-slide PowerPoint that we prepared over the last 2 weeks working on this so hard. And we went the scenario because actually what we were faced with or charged with is reality. It's not, we don't need to make anything up because it's really happening, and that is we don't have watershed plans where you don't have watershed plans or much of anything in the watershed, and you have to make some permit decisions and mitigation and that kind of stuff. So when I got tagged for this a few months ago, like Palmer called me about it and said, you know, you won't be on this panel. And I saw, okay, well, who's that with? You know, he's like, well, CORE. And no, I was like, okay, well, NIMS, no problem. CORE and mitigation, I don't know. This is going to be interesting. But we had a couple conference calls, and we've met 2 or 3 times since then. And I don't know if I'm thinking like a CORE person or the CORE person thinking like EPA, which is scarier. But we've really kind of come from the same place on this. And it's, you know, the real world again and the difficulty. So we were charged with coming up maybe with some guidance. And what we've come down to is there's a lot of flexibility, we think, already out there. It really boils down to case by case, by best professional judgment and experience a lot of times. So our formal regulator here has got some pieces of, some guidance for us or potential guidance for us. At least to start, throw it out there. That's how we thought we'd really actually do this because, I mean, it's really not a lot. We can discuss it. We don't have any bullets or PowerPoints for you on this. And we'll just go through and discuss it and then kind of open it up for some discussion. Okay?
Okay, I just want to say that even though I am the loudmouth regulator here, sure. One of them, which is why I was invited. If on, you know, in the screen of your mind, you can imagine all of the regulators out there in all of those districts of the CORE, most of them without any plans for the particular watershed they're working in at the time. Maybe there's a plan in their district, it's only for one watershed. So most of the work that people are doing, and therefore the permits that these guys are commenting on, are ones without watershed plans. And districts have their own culture. Individual project managers have their own backgrounds. Could be not anything to do with biology. Could be specialized in one aspect of biology and that maybe they know a lot about insects but not very much about wetlands. There's such a diversity of backgrounds and interest out there among all of the project managers that exist and that are making permits every day. So I'm trying to represent as much as I can everybody who's out there and trying to think of what are the kinds of things that guidance might say to give some encouragement to those folks who want to expand their horizons to include watershed context or to expand a little bit even from the on-site in-kind, which of course in my district we've been kind of outside those lines for quite a while, even though that's where we start. And I And we're Roxanne is nicely writing up for. I did write up just a straw person that we can all throw darts at of a few sentences that might be in the guidance that might relate to the to people who are just like me who are just kind of sitting out there with no plans. And normally, most project managers, whether they do or not, these options are already all available to them, everything that's up here. So that's already happening. So in terms of the criteria that we're talking about, we certainly have to look at the condition with so what's happening at the wetland that we're, for which a permit a permit is being applied for. And logistics, you know, we always get that from the consultants anyway, and the social aspect often is small, and again, we're talking about, I think here we're talking primarily about individual permits. But, you know, remember that there are two different kinds of programs, the nationwide permits, and those tend to have, of course, less review than others. And again, that may depend also on the district you're in. And so what we're kind of looking for, is there anything that we can add to what's already over here that would broaden the viewpoint? And so these folks are the guys I usually consult with. Would you like to make a comment?
Yeah.
I'm initiating a consultation.
Okay.
Now that the consultation's been initiated, I guess I can speak. you know,
it may affect.
In the absence of a plan, like Richard said, I think we are stuck with business as it is, a case-by-case basis, and looking for on-site, in-kind, first and foremost. And when it's not appropriate, or it doesn't seem to fit, then beginning to expand, looking at other sites, off-site, out of kind. But as far as providing guidance to that, that's a very difficult thing, especially without a plan in place. The thing that's worked most for me is coordination with other agencies, and that's state, federal, and local. There's a lot of people out there with plans in place and ideas of how it should look, and if you tap into that, then you might get some better mitigation when you, without a plan. So,
I wrote out some of the things that came out of our discussions, and Roxanne just kindly printed it up so that everybody could see it. So these are just a couple of sentences that people can throw whatever you want at, but wait until we get out of the way. Something along the lines of a core project manager should make compensatory mitigation systems with decisions with reference to the watershed location and functions of the aquatic resource to be filled. So now all it does is just say watershed location and functions. Just adds that to people's consciousness. And then compensatory mitigation should replace lost aquatic functions either on-site or as close to the impact site as possible, and actually I changed that to feasible, and in a landscape position appropriate to both the target functions and the mitigation location. So I think these are the concepts that kind of add to this. So this is going to replacing lost aquatic functions. It's not saying it has to be the same, so it kind of gets into the things that Suzanne and other people were talking about. And then either on site or as close to the impact site as feasible, because feasibility then can also get into the thought that you could go further away in order to produce that function. So this is my this is as much as we could come up with. We have been talking on the phone about this. We've been meeting during this symposium and racking our brains and trying to think what additional layer, what additional wording could we put in a guidance that would actually
sort of expand the thinking of people in the field. And there's not a lot that you can do, because there is already, you know, people are going to coordinate with other agencies. The project managers are, generally speaking, they're already doing it. If a project manager isn't, it isn't their style of doing it, and they may not be coordinating a lot. You know, you can coordinate just by, I could write a letter, consultation letter to this guy. I could get a letter from him, and I could say thanks very much and put it in the file. And I don't have to talk to these guys. My own personal style is to call everybody and say, okay, what are we going to do about this one? But that's just me, and there's lots of people who don't do that. And I think if they don't do that, it's because it's not in their nature to do it, generally speaking. So no matter what you say, but it's nice to talk to other agencies. Some people will, some people won't. So what are the things that we can also say to the project managers to expand their horizons? Okay, start shooting.
Well, let me add real quick. We talked about maybe like a checklist or something that either the processor core person would work off of or would provide an applicant, and that might be where we don't where we don't have a plan. You know, we talked about like a laundry list of people in OSHA that might have some form of some kind of prioritization. Maybe a refuge has in holdings that they want to buy, or the Nature Conservancy has identified a special unique tract. If these people are consulted or checked, you know, that can be brought into as a possible mitigation location, and it should be considered by everybody. You know, that's kind of getting out into the little more than maybe than, I mean, some people do it now, like you said, but if there was some guidance that talked about maybe a hit list of some kind to check in the guidance, that might help push those people who normally don't do that kind of communication. That might be beneficial.
Eric?
Bill
and Andy.
Purposely waited to round this whole thing.
I've said this to a couple people over the last couple of days. One of the things that, in my opinion, that when the mitigation banking guidance came out, it's, you know, in my opinion, I think one of the better pieces of guidance that's ever come out of DC. And one of the things that it did, it's not prescriptive, but it included some thoughts and some suggestions. And when it comes out in guidance, it allows regulators to essentially fall back on that. So when they're challenged by a consultant or an applicant, they can say, well, I've got this guidance that suggests that I consider these things. And so that's a good thing that a regulator can fall back on. So there's probably elements with that thought in mind, there's probably elements that guidance could include that, you know, advise regulators of things that they can consider, you know, in evaluating a permit that allows them to take a watershed perspective. And we've heard a lot of those things these last couple of days. We've heard about you have to consider movement of water and up and downstream effects. You've got to consider movement of sediment. You've got to consider connectivity. You've got to consider regional uniqueness. I mean, these are all things we've talked about and things that people do. But having those things even listed in a bullet form and a guidance, I think, then allows field regulators to say, if they're challenged, you know, if they're trying to do that, say, I want to look at this impact in the context of the movement of water through this watershed, and I've got this guidance that says I'm allowed to look at that or I should be looking at that.
So what are the hits that you think that the guidance should guide people to consider?
Well, I just,
are they criteria? Are they?
Okay, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things we talked about.
No, connectivity.
Oh, and I just said, you know, movement. Right. You know, movement of water. I mean, somebody even termed it. What was it? Routing and supply of water, or water source and routing. Is that you, Josh? You
Washington Department of Transportation.
But it was basically something with movement of water, movement of sediment. I think Dick, you had these in your presentation.
We use larch wood and heat, maybe.
Connectivity of habitat, hatches.
Aquatic integrity and habitat connectivity.
So.
I
think more connectivity of.
These have to be watershed expand. We already look at this stuff. Least on a project location by location basis, but it's expanding into the watershed.
Right. So I guess it says these criteria need to be considered on a watershed scale.
I have Bill, Andy, Jeanette, Steve, Susan Marines. Bill, you're next.
I wonder, I'll throw this out, and I don't know where it can actually hit the road, but along the lines of what Eric is saying, is it possible, in the sense that we look at watersheds in sort of a hierarchical spatial way, you know, from the site all the way up or all the way back down, could you provide guidance that was hierarchical? That in cases where you have all this information, the watershed context type guidance, I'll throw this out, may take precedence over on-site in kind. And look in situations
so hierarchical based on the amount of information that's available?
Yeah. And the type of information that's
so
available.
The type of information.
And yeah, I mean, you know, there's lots, you know, the devil's always in the details, so, you know, it's like what kind of information and where and all that kind of stuff. But then you get down really to that second page, and that's like the baseline. You know, if you have no information, then we're back to where we've been for a long time. Is mitigation replaces the loss of aquatic functions as close to the impact site as possible.
Exactly.
George, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I was just going to say that was, you know, was brought up in the last section. You know, looking at putting that level, say that that's level in place, and when it didn't apply, then getting back to business as usual, which is on-site in kind.
I think when we were talking about a hierarchical level before, my understanding was different levels of analysis having criteria. But here it's kind of, because the hierarchy is depending on what kind of information you get. The more information you have, the more flexibility
right.
you should be allowed, which I think
right.
I heard from the last
right.
panel. Yeah,
right.
Oh, that's, okay,
right.
from the last
right.
panel discussion
right.
too, but yeah.
Good thing.
Okay.
Right.
I have Andy, or do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I want to say that what I'd like us to end up with to get into the next session is maybe a list like this, like those, that relate to the watershed, that go in the direction of what Eric said, just like a list. What do I want to say? A bulleted list on a watershed basis.
I have Andy and then Jeanette.
Yeah.
Yep.
I got him there. As an academic, I guess I get the freedom to be a critic and a snob sometimes about it. You know, drive around the watersheds.
Go ahead.
Well, I got like watersheds and go, okay, that's a nice one, which yeah. must be rare, or what in the world are they thinking, which is much more common. In the absence of a plan, do you guys formulate your own map or your own plan in your head where you'd like things to be, and is there any way to formalize that?
Nope, but applicant proposes to us where they would like to do a mitigation.
You cannot suggest or point or...
We could say, have you talked to so-and-so or have you considered this, or why don't you look around to see what's nearby.
Yeah. Could you also require them to analyze more or do
yes,
more?
Yes, to analyze more, but we can't require them.
There's all that expertise that's getting lost there. Somehow,
we're
not being able to
be
fully applied.
Well, where is that expertise?
In you guys.
Yeah. Well, there are cases where an applicant may be willing. It's like, you know, tell us what you want. And I know cases right now where we're working on Fish and Wildlife's going out looking, trying to identify in an area of where bottomland hardwoods are being taken out, some areas they want to, you know, lock up or link up. And so, yeah, there are opportunities if the applicant's willing to work that way. But we can't necessarily go out and force them, saying we want you to go here. If they say, where can we go? Sure, we can do that.
Kind of looks at an ecosystem approach for essential fish habitat.
We can do that.
When evaluating mitigation, we're allowed to do that. We're allowed to think outside of the box a little bit. So that helps us in fisheries, but it doesn't necessarily help the core regulator.
They can't make them go there either.
There's ways of pushing people in certain directions.
Time is money.
I have Jeanette, and then I have Steve, but I don't remember which one.
Well, this is from Ali, but first of all, just so everybody here knows, and most of you probably do, but maybe not, you know, there's a lot of other documents that are coming out in the Mitigation Action Plan, and some of them are being done. And we I don't want to speak for the group, but I'm on the work group, and pretty much we hope that those documents are going to culminate in this really good watershed guidance and can be essentially maybe even improved and finalized better once we get to this watershed point next year. But Molly, and one of those documents is about out-of-kind and off-site mitigation. So we've already dived into that subject last year. It's still not done. It's out on public notice, or not on public notice. It's out in the register for people to look at. If you want, you go to our mitigationactionplan.gov, which is our website, and your agency website, just so folks can know. I'm sure you've seen the different variations, and I'm wondering if you've seen the latest and how you think it's addressing some of this, you know, getting away from that hard preference. The preference is still there for on-site in kind, and there's a little bit in that in the guidance about why that is, but we really give a lot of flexibility because we know in a lot of districts there already are flexible with it, and essentially it's bringing other people along to really think outside the box as far as that that preference. Do you think that addresses some of this concern? Because this being too stringent on remaining on site was a big thing in the NRC report. It's been brought up a number of times in this meeting.
Honestly, I can't remember what the latest version is like.
You've got another 2 weeks to look at.
Thank you.
It says what the core is doing.
Okay. I know I'm one of the commenters for the core. I'm the division, South Pacific Division focus commenter on these guidelines. And so I've seen them all, and I have to just for a moment, since I'm representing kind of regulators, I've been really impressed with that. There's one lead commenter for every division in the Corps on these guidelines, so there's a lot of districts represented and division. The whole country is represented in commenting, giving feedback on these on this guidance, and I think Corps folks have done a terrific job in providing feedback. And I remember being very pleased by subsequent versions, and I just can't remember enough about the specific since I was working on a permit before I left.
So does that guide more or less reinforce what you already do, or is it going to change?
Since I can't remember the specifics,
trust me, you're already doing it.
Yes.
What he said. But it's not, you know, I'm certainly, any given project manager is atypical of the entire suite of project managers, so I'm in a very specific place, and this concept of giving people flexibility to move outward is apparently really pretty important in some places to where project managers are in their cubicles.
Yes.
Sticking here.
I have a queue of Steve, Susan Marie, Josh, and Ken, but before I go to that queue, I just want to make sure people just jumped at you with a bunch of questions. Did you have a chance to kind of get out all of the points you wanted to make first, George?
I was just going to say that according to our act, the Fisheries Conservation Act, Langston Stevenson, I'm sorry, let me just stand up. That's a little easier for me to talk when I'm sitting down. The Langston Stevenson Act requires us to look at an ecosystem approach. And for me, for central fish habitat, right. So for me, and for my Habitat Conservation Division, that's something we've been doing all along. And looking to guidance helps stimulate that in the absence of a watershed approach. I really think the most important thing for other regulators is to coordinate with interagency coordination and state and federal and local coordination. Because a lot of information that's out there is based on cumulative knowledge from all these other agencies. The only way to tap into that is through coordination. So I guess that's the guidance part for me, on how to adjust the five logical steps through coordination.
At least most likely they're going to be interagency. And if we start talking about looking at things in a watershed context, if we start talking about communication, it's not just going to be the Corps hearing that, it's going to be Fish and Wildlife Service, it's going to be everybody hearing it, because I think sometimes the blocks are not just the Corps sitting in the cubicle, it can be other agencies doing that too. You know, we got our, if it's not endangered species, don't come talk to me people in our field too, and so that may help actually bring this along, is that not only can we emphasize that in our guidance, but it's going to be hopefully signed by all the agencies as guidance.
Okay, I have
just an observation. I know they'll write guidance, so it's a suggestion, I guess. I see kind of a couple of parallel universes here. I see the regulatory universe that I'm in right now, and then you've got the planning universe that seems to be running in parallel. There are a lot of opportunities that could be enhanced by what's going on in planning. For instance, there are programs that provide assistance to the state for conducting watershed studies, which you can benefit from. So if it's not already ongoing, at least within the Corps, there would be opportunity, I would think, to tap into non-regulatory types of resources that bring the science together.
Bob wrote a report that really focused on this issue. This report on SAMs and ADIDs and about the
that was a regulatory though.
You can know this report that you wrote. I think it was part of the mitigation mechanisms.
So there are a number of opportunities for planning and territory to work together. And your point, the second point too, is certainly an opportunity.
And that's just one. I mean, you can get up to $500,000 now for a watershed plan that stick a regulator on there, could actually identify places for compensatory mitigation.
In the development of this guidance, is that something that the Corps is thinking about at all, about how the planning side and the regulatory side can coordinate more, and it could bring some of those planning resources to bear on the
situation? There's another effort that's ongoing that's working. It's not part of a map item, but there are other efforts ongoing that they're going to work at getting our different functions together, and a lot of it's going to be driven by data sharing. In fact, that's going to be an AGIS or a way of getting not only intra-agency but inter-agency cooperation is through data sharing, through a GIS data sharing.
So there could certainly be GIS data sharing, but in terms of overall planning for a watershed, I just want to say that the plans that you're talking about on the planning side of the Corps, it takes forever. Funding from somebody to develop land somewhere, and then the plan takes forever, and meanwhile we're going like this. So it's a big umbrella kind of thing, and that is the reason to me that there's not a lot more interaction, because people on the planning side are generally working on a project or a few projects for a very long time, and you know we're working on tons of projects all the time, and the places where we can interact, we're trying to do that, but it's not a lot. But certainly once we get the data stuff, that can start populating each other's maps and stuff.
I have Susan Marie, Josh, Ken, Suzanne. Susan Marie.
I was shocked to see the pretty much reliance on a preference for on-site in-kind here. Let me finish. Or as close to the impact size as possible. I think part of my question's been answered by what Bill said in terms of that we might need to do a hierarchical or a nested
in the context of a place where there's no planning and no plan. Okay.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is, okay, there's no plan, but as the paper that you copied for us talked about in the experience of the In Lieu Fee program, people have plans in their heads. They, particularly people who've worked in the same area for a long time, they know what's going on, they have their own sense. And what I thought was interesting about the article about In Lieu Fee programs is it said, well, the core regulator and the In Lieu Fee administrator kind of come to a consensus on their vision for the watershed, and that's how the In Lieu Fee gets cited. And that made me a little nervous because that's just two people, and so I guess what I'm getting at is, okay, there's no plan, but there's a lot of professional experience, and there needs to be, I think, a way to get people, you, Fish and Wildlife, NIMS, together and say, okay, we don't have a plan, but we know a lot about this watershed.
That's for Georgia's,
and it might be, I haven't heard anyone mention pre-application stuff, but that might be one way of doing it. But I think that if we write watershed guidance that says if you've got no plan, we're back to a preference for on-site or as close to the impact site as possible, then we won't really feel like we've done our job.
Can you suggest some alternate wording that...
Well, what I'm thinking is what Bill said about a hierarchical approach. Well, first of all, and I think we probably need to put in that guidance pretty strong indication. Go out and find what information you can. There may not be a plan, but there's information. If we're going to do a watershed approach, we have to go out and find it. And then maybe the carrot of developing regulatory pieces like a regional general permit or something might be an incentive for people to develop plans or pull some of this information together. But I think we're going to need to be on slightly riskier ground, even if we don't have an actual plan.
Josh Kent, Suzanne, I have you in a queue. Are you willing to yield the floor to Bob and John for a second? I'll get back to you. I won't lose you. Bob's jumping out of the seat here.
Follow up on what Susan Marie said. I was sort of shocked by item two. And I thought, well, maybe it depends on which of those is precedent. But I was thinking about what the NRC report said and realized that there's a possibility of taking this out of context, which is really easy to do with NRC. But one of your reaction to this is talking about implications of a watershed approach. One way to set goals for wetland functions is to seek to replace those lost in the Section 404 permit. And it says that such a that compensation goal might imply that the watershed was in some desired condition before the permit was issued, and the compensation will ensure a return to that condition. That's one of the assumptions they talked about. A second assumption they said also exact replacement is also warranted if the particular wetland loss to the permitted activity was the type critical to watershed conditions. So it listed those two examples of defending that first goal. And it goes on to say at the end of this paragraph, talking about what the MOA does and the MLUP guidance and all of that, either of these arguments may be valid, but they need to be analytically defended when the compensation for each permit is being considered. In other words, it sort of questions this preference. It says, it needs to be defended rather than used as a support.
I want to respond to that, and the reason it's in here, Susan Marie and Bob and others, is because of George. Because in this George here, Richard George.
Yeah, George. Bend your notes.
when we were having our phone conversations, and you know, most of the stuff I do is actually offsite. He was talking about situations where he's got they're making permit decisions here, and 300 miles away is a mitigation bank where somebody said, somebody somehow got the service area spread all the way, 300 miles away, and the project managers involved, should they want to keep it more in the watershed, closer to the source, don't have the field data, don't have the ability to bring it back closer. They feel like they have to buy into that thing that's so far away. So that is actually why it's written this way. Is there a way to keep it, more appropriate to the impact site and not quite so far away? So that is actually why it was written.
Well, let me add to that too, because that is a kind of extreme case, but we do have that, and there's unfortunate reasons for that. But I don't, in the movement to go to the embrace this bigger picture and everything, then that's great, and we want to get there, and if we have these plans, it's going to be wonderful. The concern is that we, yes, on-site in kind has failed, but it's failed for a lot of different reasons. There's been a lot of bad planning. Not necessarily just because it was on-kind in-site. Not the reason why it failed. There's other reasons for that. That in itself is not a bad thing, and there are plenty of opportunities in my region especially in Louisiana, South Louisiana, where so much of the marginal, I mean, wetlands have been cleared for cropland, they're marginal, it's so easy to put that stuff back. And there are plenty of opportunities there. So I don't want a knee-jerk reaction that we immediately shoot off to the extreme edge of a watershed just because there's a bank or something up there. I think it should be as close to the impact site that's appropriate. But so let's don't just yank people out. Let's look here, and if it's appropriate, great. And if we got it, great. But then let's also, while we're doing that consideration, we're willing to consider the thing, that's fine. But we as regulators need that ability to have some common sense and some reason here, in the sense that we're going to be yanked, and we are yanked by, you know, bankers that came in early in the game and got pretty big service areas for whatever reason. Those people, you know, if they're not allowed to use it. And I will say this too, the problem in the history of this, I remember a time when my management, I first heard about banks and I thought, man, it sounds kind of cool, you know, pretty reasonable. We're going to consolidate stuff and we can manage it better. Management said, heck no, we're not going to support that. APA does not support mitigation banking. We didn't do it. Now we've gone to, we've signed 60 or 70 banks or something in Louisiana. And the expediency of banks, the processors are working. I mean, they're there, they're available. Mitigation goes there. I don't know if that's a good thing because we're not considering anything else. We're not thinking about, well, was there something else on this stream segment, on this farm that could have been linked back up? No, well, because it's so easy, the guy writes a check and the permit's issued, we go there. So that's my worry about just jumping to these extremes.
There's a reason we call them the revolutionary
assembly. The problem is we're going to say that if you do have a watershed assessment, you could actually use that to defend inside non-contract.
Right.
The problem is we don't.
So in an ideal world, it's...
But whatever guidance we put out, it sounds like, needs to say on-site in kind, it can also be appropriate for the watershed.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Somehow.
Yes. That's yes. Yes. The appropriate. On-site in kind. I'm going to advise our queue here. Josh, Ken, Suzanne, and John.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize the importance of coordination, communication. Andrew was saying, George was saying, as being said over here, not just in the sense of interpreting an existing set of guidelines for the landscape when a plan does exist, but also when it doesn't exist. There's no other way to capture the experiential understanding about the place besides getting you all thinking together about the site at the same time. Now, we've been trying to do this, and you know, this is how hard it is. Our agency cultures want to work this way. It requires a single staff person to get a coordination meeting out, to get an agenda out the door. We're having a hard time even funding that one person for more than 2 years. Now, the more you can do to say through the guidelines, we really need to think about how we do this together. A large part of watersheds is not just water supply and sediment supply and vegetation and integrating across larger area. It's more people working well together. That's really the watershed concept. I'd even take it away from the land and say, in terms of regulation and management, it's not even about those things. It's about people. It's about you all working well together. And so you really have to make sure that these guidelines, I know I'm being a little bit pedantic here, we're trying to make this happen. We've seen how successful it's been. We've seen the agencies going, wow, this is really working. And the applicants saying, my God, this project is really exciting now. This is going to be really good. And yet we can't even keep that good thing going for lack of like $60,000 a year to fund somebody to even manage the meetings and take minutes.
This is a person that works through a nonprofit.
The funding system helps this overarching organization stay together.
Yeah, so I know what this can be like to actually make happen. The second point would be, when we get down to this list of things that Molly was talking about in the watershed context, we found that there are really three things that seem to really matter the most. If you have to go, you know, factors, criteria, or data, it's the historical and modern sediment supply, water supply, and vegetation patterns. Pollutants are great, people are great, but really, in the hands of all of you, if you can see the past sediment, the past water, and the past plants, you can start making all kinds of inferences about what this site might do in the future. And those things come through NWI and a few other, and USGS and a few other places.
I think you're talking mostly about right around the bay.
I'm talking about watersheds.
Yeah, but those things don't necessarily work the same way up in the hills.
No, I'm talking about, you know, a watershed picture of the distribution of sediment water sources, transport, and storage places. when you get a planimetric view of those of that structural organization of the watershed, past and present, you begin to see what people have done to the watershed.
Yeah. I have Ken, Suzanne, and John.
Well, I want to reinforce some of the things that were said here, and I want to support the direction that the panel's going. There's been an implication in the last couple of days that it would be great and ideal to have this geographic understanding of the watershed and have all those things arrayed in front of us with multiple layers and so on and so forth. And I think that's actually not necessarily true. That in some cases it's very valuable, but I could argue that in some cases it's overkill. That when you're finished doing, and it's good to have all that stuff arrayed, but when you have it all arrayed, you have to make value judgments about putting weights on various components of the watershed. That's number one. Number two, you're going to find out when you look at replacing a particular wetland that its impact is going to be not very far away. That is, the impact it has diminishes exponentially with distance and in the downstream direction. Okay? And so it seems to me that you can do quite well if you do the things we've talked about. If you're communicating with the resource people around, if you know what the really high priority items are downstream of the site you're looking at, is it a lake? Is it Chesapeake Bay? Is it San Francisco Bay? Is it an important wetland? Is it a threatened and endangered species? Whatever. If you know where those are, I think you can do a really good job. It's probably as good as what you're going to get if you do the very, very careful analysis. So I think you have to be informed. You have to communicate. But I don't know that you have to have all that. That other stuff's great. And if you have it because it's available for some other reasons, fine. But I don't know that it would be cost effective to develop it for what you're trying to do. And so I think we don't want to write this thing up as ideally you have a plan and if you don't you're a poor second cousin and you're not going to do very well. I disagree. I think you can do very well, and just because the benefits are going to be not that far downstream and you should be able to find the critical things that are being impacted or being protected or benefited by that wetland that's being taken out.
The land has to be available for
this. Right.
So, I mean, you're talking about the question in the context of there not being an existing plan, and your main point is that you don't need to do this enormous watershed planning effort to make it.
That's right. Well, I don't want to let it up. I don't want to say that those poor people that don't have a plan are going to have to get by. I think they can be very successful, maybe just as well, in a lot of cases, if you have people who are willing to communicate with others around.
And do you think in that situation it's important to just kind of say communication becomes more important, or do you think you need to be explicit about what types of...
Well, I think you need to say they need to identify what the really critical resources are downstream to the site that's being impacted. That would be the one piece of advice, and then find out what they can about that. But I don't think you necessarily need all that. High-powered analysis, because in the end there's subjectivity that's going to go into that too.
Do you think it needs to be clear about defining what the bare minimum information to be considered, the bare minimum criteria?
Well, I mean, I don't think you can specify bare minimum as much as I think identifying again and understanding what as best you can what impact that affected site has or benefits it has to downstream resources and what are the most important downstream resources in that particular sub watershed. You don't have to be thinking about everything. It's just that whatever's downstream of there, because there's probably something not that far downstream that's going to be the center of your attention. It should be the center of your attention.
Suzanne, real quick, before I address what I raised my hand for, I would just build on that and say, you know, there's a lot of different ways to define a watershed plan. And in our state, we are applying different types of watershed assessments in different areas depending upon the need, and there are probably places where it doesn't make sense to do a real high intensity watershed planning effort. And so I think your point's well taken, but I think you need to look across the board and say, well, is this an area that it would be a benefit to have it? But I wanted to say that I guess one thing we are saying is that, in general, there is a preference to have a watershed plan because we're talking about presence and absence of it, and we've said there's a potential hierarchy where, in the absence of it, we're doing business as usual. So we're sort of, you know, saying, and there is a preference. If there's a preference for it, then we need to be able to promote it. One thing I didn't mention in my presentation, and it kind of goes to what you said, Molly, about the funding of it, I just thought you might benefit from knowing how we fund it in North Carolina, which is, I think, a very sort of creative way of looking how we can get these things accomplished. we're working closely with our Department of Transportation, and they invested, prior to the existence of our program, a whole lot of money in site ID. They would pay consultants hundreds of thousands of dollars to do site searches, and those site searches were driven by land availability. They weren't driven by environmental concerns necessarily. Just, you know, where do we have degradation on a parcel that's for sale? Well, we factored that that's about 10% of the overall mitigation cost, and we're taking that 10% of overall mitigation cost now and investing it in watershed planning. And when you take 10% of $100 million over a two-year period, that's $10 million on watershed planning. I mean, we're getting, I mean, it's compared to how much is being spent on the actual restoration mitigation part, it's not a whole lot, but by itself, it's a whole lot. I mean, we're spending $400,000 on an individual plan. And we're getting really good stuff out of it.
So. I'll ask Governor Schwarzenegger
how that expenditure of money in the next year.
It's just a different way of thinking about, you know, looking at where those funds are being invested. If they're just spending funds, if DOT or other entities are just throwing money at finding feasible sites, maybe that money could be spent in another way.
I just want to clarify two things that you said. One thing is, I think you made the point that when there's not a big watershed and plan in place, which we do business as usual, but something I've heard the past 2 days is that that's not necessary. There are other alternative ways to do a simple sort of a checklist. We're talking about the checklist
to add a level.
We can still make these decisions in a watershed context. It's not exactly what it's business as usual, but it's without a huge big planning effort. Another point you made, though, is which I think was interesting, is you know, when you get to the, at what point do you get to make the decision? Okay, we need the plan. We've been relying on this checklist, simple approach. At some point, in areas, for example, that haven't had a lot of development and suddenly do, you know, they're going to have to make that decision to make that investment. I think one thing that's important to do is hopefully that the point where that decision is made can still be done in a way that's proactive and not reactive. So you're not only, if you look at a lot of places where plans are in place, it's because, yeah, you know, you've already lost 90% of resources. You know, it's highly urbanized already, but you kind of want that plan to start earlier than that, right? So that you're getting the big picture and you're not, you're not trying to just replace the things that are already lost.
Yeah, and that does happen.
So this is a temporal issue as well about when the plan should maybe replace just this more streamlined checklist.
We usually have to convince somebody else to pay for it.
No, that was helpful.
Just on the paying part, something we've done in the region, we get discretionary fund. I mean, not discretionary. We get state 104B3 money. Every year, and we've done planning. We've had it. Watershed planning has been a topic that they can apply for a while. But and really, all we've gotten is plans. A lot of times, it's identification of resources. A lot of tribes have gone out and mapped their wetlands and stuff like that. Not a lot of regulated activity going on in those areas. But we've gotten various levels of plans, and because of the workload, regulatory workload, and whatever else, we've not really, you know, pushed for improving the quality of those in the past. Years, I'm talking about 4, 5, 6 years ago. Each year we've kind of started taking a little more of a look. This year, unfortunately, we've rearranged in my section, and now I am kind of charged with that, improving that area. And I've gotten away with it so far. I've threw in that for requirement for funding under a watershed plan, there has to be actual implementation of a plan. In the past, there's not ever been that. They can do it and they can set it on the shelf, and there's no implementation. We said we're not going to fund it unless you have some kind of an implementation. So I don't know what that means necessarily, but that's something for us to evaluate. But that's where we're going, I think. And hopefully there'll be more. You know, I can push more of this with the states, and maybe this kind of help out in some of these areas. But so anyway, that's just a note on funding.
John and Jeff is in my queue, and then I want to do a little reality check about timing.
Okay. I can't tell you how excited I am about this discussion. And I can't tell you how exciting I've found this whole 2.5 days. I told you yesterday that I don't like the expression paradigm shift, so and I do like hysteresis, but I've already used that. So what I'm now going to say is I'm going to use the expression sea change, two expressions I still like, sea change and appropriate mitigation. If you're any kind of an historian about this program, and you go back and look at the various agency regulations, you look at the Corps' 1982 regulations, and then the 1986 regulations with the footnote about mitigation, what you can see is that the Corps of Engineers anyway has been struggling with how to do the best job with mitigation, and I think we all have in our own way, and I think this conversation and what's going on with this particular map issue, it really is trying to help us all undergo a sea change. And the sea change has to do with how we look at appropriate mitigation. You know, historically we've tried to, you know, historically I remember there were a lot of people that thought creation was the only way to go. Well, I think we all now know that's, you know, that can work in certain instances, but restoration enhancement is much better. For whatever guidance comes out of the map, you need to make sure that it's centered around the concept of appropriate mitigation, and gives some general guidance about when it might be better to think in kind and on site, but also widen people's horizon to really take a look more. From a watershed perspective, and now I'm sort of losing. I'm probably gonna lose it here, but the concept of appropriate mitigation needs to be maintained through all of this, and it needs to be maintained in whatever guidance comes out in a flexible way. Because I'm here to tell you that when we're dealing with mitigation bankers, for example, in mitigation service areas, they got the jump on us in Florida, and so we have mitigation service areas that are humongous. And there are situations where I feel very comfortable, and as long as I've got the right, you know, as long as I have the flexibility to say I'm looking for appropriate mitigation, I can tell them, and I can make a technical argument for why I don't think their bank ought to be used. There are other situations where I will want to use their bank because it is in the right place. It does offer the right context, and it is the appropriate thing to do. So whatever you all do, and I put this together. This has been a painful experience for me because I've been trying to digest all this stuff. And I put this thing together, and maybe somebody else. But you've got an opportunity here to help make a sea change in a really good direction. I think you've got a bunch of good ideas. Do it. Don't blow it.
One thing I just wondered about, and maybe Richard, you can comment from EPA. We, a lot of places use 319 funds for some watershed planning, but we have these new 9 criteria that all watershed plans have to include in order to be eligible for any 319 funds for projects. And so I'm thinking maybe, you know, this sort of relates to going towards watershed planning, assuming that's desirable in those areas that don't have it. We need to make sure the two programs are aligned. They're really from different parts of the Clean Water Act, but we have a lot of watersheds that have watershed plans that were done by NRCS, they were led by NRCS, they used a great stakeholder involvement process, but the EPA does not recognize them because they don't meet their new 9 criteria.
9 criteria are for, what are they?
There are 9 elements that were issued by the US EPA that you have to be considered a watershed-based plan and be eligible for any 319 funds. Okay. Is that national or was that just our region?
That's national.
That's national, right? Okay. So it just seems like in doing this, we need to not end up saying things that run afoul of where EPA is trying to go with watershed planning under their 319 program.
It actually acknowledges the first scenario we have, which is you don't want to constrain it so much that it can't involve existing relationships and structures and places where there's a lot of information. So
necessary. You don't want to end up throwing out a lot of information that's important because there's only nine.
Right, but maybe this is a chance for the 319 part of the Clean Water Act to interact with the 404 part, which heretofore I don't think they do.
Molly, you want to Yeah, I just want to take this opportunity to, when we're talking about sea changes and stuff, to acknowledge my friend and former Trenches companion, Mark Sudol. I think that Park, being the current chief of regulatory, has made a lot of this stuff possible, and that he was chosen is probably exemplary of sort of where it was going. But I think that a lot of this ability to shift is due to Mark and his staff. I think Kathy's sitting over there. And Mr. Gooden over there from EPA, they can work with each other, and they have been working with each other. In the MAP group, whatever goes on inside the MAP group, and I don't know the details, but I do read the minutes, but I think the juicy details are not in there.
Oh yeah.
And Paul, so I just do want to acknowledge that, because I think it really, Mark's being there from the Corps' point of view, and the other agency, but of course Palmer, trying to hold it all together, is really important in this. So thank you.
A big round of applause for Mark.
I think he'd rather have staff.
We have about 15 more minutes before we have to do the wrap up. Some of the work group members asked me to. I mean, this last few minutes is the last opportunity in this setting for you to kind of give the MAP work group your golden nuggets. And what one of the ways that they asked me to kind of to phrase the question in terms of, to get you thinking is. You know, what recommendations would you give about what could or should be in the federal guidance? They'd like you to think about that, letting go of your constraints, whether it's from the NGO perspective or the corporate perspective or the regulatory perspective, or the letting go of those constraints. In the perfect world, I guess there were kind of, this idea came from Josh's presentation on the first day, where he said one of the successes in the San Francisco effort was that people sat around the table and started from the premise that those constraints didn't exist. Let's do what's right for ecology, and we'll deal with the reality later, or something along those lines, right?
Yeah.